I went looking for a story, and my friend Lynn brought me an adventure.
It's okay, we're Americans. We're here to help you.
My name is Bob Wilton. I'm a journalist. I've been investigating a story about a classified government program. I'd heard that the U.S. government was training psychic soldiers, and that Lynn Cassidy was the best of the best.
I've been reactivated. I'm on a mission.
I could come. Lynn's story was unbelievable, crazy, and completely true.
You must create warrior monks who can pass through walls and see into the future. Holy.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and here it is. Showtime again. And we have an interesting show tonight, and we urge you to stay tuned. Remember, we did a remote viewing special a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to get this fellow on that we're going to introduce in a minute, but he was on vacation. So we decided we'd ask him to come back the following Monday, and guess what? He was having a birthday party. But we finally have him, and it's Paul H. Smith, and we'll talk to him in a moment. I got a card, a very nice one this week, from an international cryptology museum person. I didn't know they had an international cryptology, but there is a museum called that. It's 11 Avon Street, and that's located in Portland, Maine. They had a painting on the card, and it's by Thomas E. Finley. And it's a painting of a sea serpent. And the sea serpent supposedly alive and is located at Gadboro Bay, is I think is the way you pronounce it, up in British Columbia. And we have not done a show in a long time on cryptozoology. In fact, I think maybe the next time we do a special, maybe we'll do something on cryptozoology and wrap it a little Bigfoot and a few things like that. If you think it's a good idea, simply email me and tell me about it at jerry@jerrypippin.com. And since I mentioned my regular email, feel free to do that. It's Post Office Box 33, Muskogee, Oklahoma, 74402. We have that address right there on our contact slip on our website, at jerrypippin.com. So feel free to correspond with us by email, phone, regular mail, you name it, we'll try it. Anyway, Paul Smith, I want to first of all say happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
And welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I think this is the first time for us, is it not?
Yes, it is. We've talked about it, maybe doing it before, but the remote viewing thing came up, and I thought we've got to get Paul Smith on because he's quite an expert. And before we even really get into the show, let's talk a little bit about what you do down there in Austin, Texas. That seems to me you've been down there for a long time.
Yeah, I moved here less than a year after I retired from the Army. Came down to Austin and brought my remote viewing training company with me, but my main purpose was to work on a PhD here at the University of Texas.
And you evidently doing it for a long time now. How long have you been down there?
That would have been, let's see, the summer of 97.
I mean, you already had a birthday, so I don't mind dating you.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, I don't mean dating you as in kissing. I mean dating you as telling how old you are.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jerry. You're just not my type. I hope you're not offended. But yeah, I guess we just passed our 15-year anniversary here in Austin. Yeah. So it's been a great place.
And it's a pretty intellectual place. A lot of people know that already. But all kinds of things happen from Austin. Tell us a little bit about your business here and what you do.
Well, I wear a lot of different hats. But as far as how I make my living, of course, there's always military retirement. That's nice. That keeps me from going broke. But I teach people remote viewing, controlled remote viewing specifically, which I learned, of course, while I was in the military remote viewing program. That's been a very interesting career. In fact, while I was working my PhD in philosophy, when my professors found out what I was doing to put myself through school, it pretty much freaked them out, as you could imagine.
What did your professor think of remote viewing? I guess he was skeptical at first.
Well, some of them were very skeptical. Some of them started off skeptical, but I wouldn't say I converted them, but they began to take it seriously, at least consider it as a legitimate possibility. And others are actually got a bit enthusiastic about it. So it was an interesting experience, not just for me, but for them as well. It was a lot of fun, actually. I always like that reveal moment when you tell somebody who you know is going to be startled, you know, what it is you do for a living. They go, "What? I didn't think that stuff worked." And then I have the opportunity to show them, well, yes, in fact, it can work, and it has worked, and the U.S. government used it for 23 years, and successfully in most cases, or in many cases.
You brought up the U.S. government using it. Do you think they still do?
Well, what can you say? That question always comes up. In fact, Lynn Buchanan, who you had on not too long ago, he has this fun thing he says. He says, well, if they're doing it and I knew about it, I couldn't tell you. And if they were doing it and I didn't know about it, I couldn't tell you. So I'll just tell you I can't tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, but we put the talk show hosts don't like those answers.
Yeah. I'll tell you, my answer is usually, I think there's a 95% chance, you know, that's of course, you know, a rough percent, but 95% chance that they are not doing it. Based on...
Why do you think they stopped?
Well, I know why they stopped. It's because the organization, the remote viewing organization, got handed over to the CIA, and the CIA didn't want to do it. In fact, the director of the CIA at the time was a huge skeptic. In fact, he was famous for tossing people out of his office if they ever brought up the word remote viewing. And there was some politics going on, and decided it was better to move it out of the military and into the CIA. And that was essentially its death sentence, because they didn't want to have anything to do with it. They very cleverly kept the personnel slots open, because then they farmed them out to all their different agencies where they needed more people to do other things. but they got rid of the program, and it's very clear that they terminated it. Now, sometimes people say, well, they could be doing it and we wouldn't know about it, which is true. I mean, it's possible that they have a really highly secret program going on somewhere deep down, buried at Langley or someplace. But given the kind, first of all, given the history of remote viewing in the government, it was always something that there was fights over. You had the supporters of it trying to keep it alive, and you had the detractors and the skeptics trying to do away with it. And in the end, the detractors won, essentially. And I don't think that the nature of government has changed since then. That if you think about it, the kind of people who end up being successful in a government agency tend to be organizational thinkers. So they're generally linear thinkers. There's a place for everything, a thing for every place. They really want closure. They don't like these open-ended things. They don't like uncertainty. And that's just exactly the opposite kind of personality that can deal well with remote viewing. And so, since you have a preponderance of those kind of folks in bureaucratic agencies, it seems kind of psychologically no surprise to me that it had those struggles, and that that they had that they had trouble with that. So,
yeah, we opened a show with a little sound clip from The Man Who Stared at Goats, and what did you think of that movie, or did you see it?
Oh, I saw it. I thought it was really funny. But also, I kind of appreciated the fact that it didn't pretend to be an accurate account. The closest thing came, it said at the beginning, more of this is, there's more truth here than you would think, or something like that. I don't remember, indicating that it wasn't all true, which it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
but it was amusing. Now, the problem I had was with the actual book that it was taken from. The movie, of course, was even more far-fetched than the book was, but the book itself pretended to be true, and in fact, some of the stories it told were true, but they were cherry-picked. So they took the sensational stories out of context and failed to tell you the other side of the story, and so it formed in people's mind an entirely different opinion about how the program was, what it did, the kinds of things it was involved in that was actually true. So it's the standard story of taking a little bit of truth and making a complete deception out of it.
Yeah, let's talk a minute about, if you don't mind, about how you got exposed to remote viewing in the military. I was looking at your bio here. It's a pretty interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
tell the audience a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean,
you weren't aware of anything like this, right?
I was completely oblivious. I had no idea there was any psychic programs going on. In fact, I was a kind of a mild skeptic. I'd gotten involved in a science fair project in junior high where, you know, the Zener cards with the wavy lines and the star and the square and all that stuff, you know, we tried to telepathically send those patterns to each other, and it was a total failure. So I had become somewhat dubious that ESP even worked. And so when I moved to Fort Meade, I had been assigned there to work in a Middle East analyst position. I went along with what my education had been up to that point, thinking this was a normal intelligence place. You know? So I moved in, however, next door to Skip Atwater, who was the operations and training officer for the unit, and across the street from Tom McNair, who was one of the viewers. And, I did not know what they did, except that they both always wore civilian clothes, and Tom had a beard. And we're talking military officers living on an Army installation. What's with that, right? So I was instantly intrigued, but I had no idea what they were doing, and they had no intention of telling me what they were doing either, right? But they were looking for new recruits for a training program that they had just contracted with the folks who developed remote viewing in the first place. And so they kind of were assessing me at a distance. I didn't even know it. One day, Tom McNair asked me, "Well, I know you're very curious about what we're doing. We'd like to tell you, but we're thinking maybe of recruiting you, but we can't tell you what it is until you finish these tests." And he gave me a bunch of psychology and personality profile tests, those kind of things, kind of standard stuff. And so I did the test, and I gave them back to him. And a little bit later, he said, "Well, you scored about where we need somebody to score, so come on over, we'll read you on. And if you want to volunteer, you can. And if not, we'll just make you sign a non-disclosure statement, and you'll have to be silent about it for the rest of your life," essentially, right? So I said, okay. So I go over there and walk into this old beat-up building, and the World War II, condemned buildings from World War II era, right? But they're still being used. So I go in the back, and Tom sits me down, and he says, "I signed this statement, non-disclosure statement." He says, "What we do here is we collect intelligence against foreign threats using a parapsychology discipline called remote viewing. Essentially, we want to ask you to volunteer to become a psychic spy." And I'm going, "What?" But it was interesting because it took about 10 seconds. I had this thought process. I used to be interested in ESP, but I thought there was nothing to it. This guy just told me that the U.S. government is using ESP to collect intelligence. That must mean there is something to it. There's no way you can keep me out of this program. I'm going to say yes right now.
Right.
Yeah, so it was...
I agree with you. That would pique my interest for damn sure.
It was fascinating.
So you volunteered. And did you guys... I'm curious how it worked in the military. I'm a veteran. I didn't do that, however, but, they seem to have regimentation in the military. They make you go to work early in the morning and stay in the evening, or you had to pick your hours, or how did that work?
Well, it was a bit more laid back than your standard tactical infantry unit that you might be in. We did have to come in usually 9 o'clock, which is about average for a garrison kind of job. You have your PT, your physical training in the morning, and then you come in about 9, and you work a standard 9 to 5, essentially. But we come in and work, but it was very flexible because they didn't want the viewers to be stressed out. in a way you could think of, you think of us as kind of their equipment, right? You know, like we're the equipment. We may be people, but we're also sort of their equipment. And so they wanted to make sure the equipment was in top form and wasn't all stressed out and not able to function properly, right? And so they made life pretty easy for us. We did, of course, have extra duties like any military institution. I was the...
One of those kind of units, but not nearly as... esoteric is what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, not many people.
And every once in a while, somebody would come in there that had just came in from Fort Benning or someplace and thought we should be soldiers, you know?
Yeah, isn't that frustrating? Yeah, you know. Well, that fortunately never really happened at Fort Meade, thank goodness. But, we could do stuff on the side. Hopefully it was business-related, you know, work-related. I used to read parapsychology books and stuff like that. Although after a while, actually, I got involved in a education program through the Department of Defense for Strategic Intelligence. So that was what I do on part time to kind of distract myself. But we would train and we would work sessions according to a set schedule, and we would teach other people as we got new recruits and we teach them. We would get involved sometimes towards the end of the. Well, the last 5-6 years of the program, we actually sometimes went places to work. So, for example, we did a job down to Key West several times, actually, down to Key West, work with Joint Task Force 4 and the counter-narcotics stuff. It was an interesting place to work. It really was. And it was relatively stress-free as far as a military job is concerned. It's really kind of unusual from that perspective.
So now you came down and transferred to academia, and also I guess all your clients these days mostly are who? Companies and corporations and advertising people, or is it just anybody?
So you have to think about it in these terms. There are actually more than one one aspect to remote viewing business. One is the training portion of where you teach people how to do it. And then there is what we call operational remote viewing, where you may get hired by somebody or may get asked by somebody to do something in a real-world target, right? Right now, I've kind of got the operational side on hold because of a bunch of other stuff that's going on. It's very time-consuming to do operational remote viewing. But when we do it, I have done work for two different corporations, maybe three, can't remember how many now. Done a number of things for police departments, private detective, for other people like that. You know.
Yeah. Now, is it for the police and private detectives? Is that like locating murder bodies and victims?
Yeah. A fairly wide range, but it isn't as much as you would think, or maybe it would be as much as you'd think because. It's remote viewing isn't widely accepted by police departments, and it isn't widely accepted in the corporate world either. You have to have some forward-thinking folks willing to go out on a limb before they'll engage a remote viewer or a remote viewing company in trying to solve a problem that they may have.
You probably find it difficult to work in an atmosphere where there's a bunch of skeptics around, or maybe not. Maybe you can prove something to them.
I mean, well, it depends. For example, when we were down at Key West working for the intel folks at JTF-4, there were skeptics and open-minded folks on the staff. And one guy, the operations officer, actually was a skeptic. And he challenged me one time because he wanted to see evidence that it really worked, you know, because he was very dubious about it. And I don't know that we ever persuaded him, but I think I set him back a little bit because I don't normally do these kind of things because they aren't really scientific. But he said that there are a lot wrote on this, so I went along with him. He got me off in the room before I was due to go on for an operational session. He said, okay, I just want to see how this works. He said, I have written down a target in my pocket, and I folded it up and several times so there's no way you can see it, and I stuck it in my pocket, and here is the number that designates this target, which is just an arbitrary number. It had no meaning as far as what the target was. I said, well, all right, I'll try it. Can't guarantee it's going to work under the circumstances, but I'll do my best. Got the paper, pencil and paper. I started going. And basically, the scenario that I sketched out was something along these lines. I had the impression of a green rolling landscape kind of early in the morning with a lot of fog and stuff, or at least it seemed early in the morning because the sun was kind of filtered and not bright yet. And there were a bunch of people in kind of primitive kind of clothes running around with edged weapons beating each other up. And I, you know, it took a little while to describe the scenario, but that's where I came. And he said, okay. And he looked really kind of shocked. He said, I that's enough. He said, I don't know what to think, but you've kind of convinced me. I said, well, okay. He hands me the paper and I unfold it. And the target he'd given me was the Battle of Hastings in 1066. So that was helpful.
Yeah. So, is remote viewing strangeness on a person? Does it wear you out?
It isn't physically tiring, but it's kind of mentally tiring.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. It seems like it might be.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny kind of tired. You know, you get going into it, and it kind of puts you in a little bit of a mild altered state. You don't start off that way. You don't have to be in an altered state to do remote viewing. But as you go through the process, it kind of takes you there, which I had not actually realized that. And somebody who's an outside observer mentioned that one time a few years back. And I thought, that's exactly right. That's what happens is when you go through the process, it kind of induces you in a mild altered state. The technical term for that is you get a little dingy, you know. But by the time you're done with that, if you spend an hour and a half in that, you just got to the point where, you know what, I'm done. I don't want to do any more of this, you know, for a while, you know, for a little bit. I want to just go do something else to kind of clear my head, you know. That's sort of the state you get in. Obviously, some people have tried to make it sound like it's dangerous or threatens your health or something, and that's all a bunch of baloney. There's no danger to it. But it does kind of get a little tired. There's actually a kind of funny story told about Mel Riley, who was a fairly widely known remote viewer, the only guy who was actually assigned to the unit twice. He'd been over in the operations building. We had two buildings, one where he did operations, one where he did all the administrative stuff. And he comes out of having done a really long session in the administrative building, and he comes over and there's a dumpster there by the building. I'm sorry, the ops building, dumpster by the building. He comes out and he pulls his keys out of his pocket and he throws them in the dumpster and goes into the admin building. Well, a guy that was with him said, well, Mel, why did you do that? And Mel says, do what? He says, you threw your keys in that dumpster. He said, I did not. He said, yes, you did. And so he had to make Mel go over and look inside the dumpster. And sure enough, there were the keys. So he fished them out of there. And the only thing he could figure was his subconscious telling him that he's in no shape to drive home.
Yeah, interesting story. Good anecdote. Let's tell everyone about how they can get a hold of you and your company. So do you have a website?
Yes, it is, of course, the standard 3 W's, .rviewer.com. That's the word viewer with the letter R in front of it. So it comes out rviewer.com.
And do they go over to that website, what do they find? What kind of stuff?
Well, that is, it tells you all about my training program. It tells you...
Are you expensive?
I am expensive, I have to say, compared to many of the others out there. But there's a reason for that. My program is very much keyed to individual instruction. So I never have more than 2 students per instructor when I do this. My basic course lasts 5 days. There's 40 hours of classroom instruction. You do a minimum of 12 actual remote viewing sessions. And then when you get done, there's homework for the next, you get 10 more sessions that you work at home, send to me, and I score them. So it's very intense, one-on-one kind of training. I mean, and obviously that's...
We all know small classrooms work, but that's really small.
Yeah, it is. Yep. Yeah, anytime I add more than 2 students, I have to pay another instructor and have to bring them on board. So, but this is really for serious people. If you're just curious about remote viewing, there's plenty of other folks out there who aren't nearly as expensive. But I tend to cater to people who are dead serious about it and who really want to go somewhere with it once they're done. So.
And where does one go with it once they adapt it and learn it and master it?
Yeah, it sounds like you're asking why do people do it, right?
Right.
And And that's an interesting question with an interesting answer. Some people come because they want to use it in investing. And you can use it there. There's a mode of remote viewing called associative remote viewing.
We talked to Russell Targ many times about the stock market.
Yeah,
and
that's the tool he uses. And many folks have actually done fairly well at it. I mean, it's work. It's not an instant bullet, magic bullet kind of thing. But it is very successful. And in fact, one case, my son was in a college course at University of Colorado. A physics professor taught a kind of a boundaries of physics, boundaries of science kind of class. It was really essentially scientific parapsychology. They learned both sides of the argument. They learned statistics, learned how to do experiments and stuff. And when he found out that my son was in the class, he invited me to come up from Austin and give a lecture on remote viewing during one class period. And then in the evening, I did a workshop where I introduced them to associative remote viewing. And in the course of that, we predicted the correct outcome of a basketball game, 12-2, which is pretty good odds. So anyway, they decided they would do their class project as an ARV, predicting the Fortune 500, not the Fortune 500, the Dow 500, whatever it is, one of the indicators, financial indicators. And one of the auditors in the class was a dot-com millionaire who said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll toss in $10,000 that you guys can play with. Now, if we win, I get all the money, but if you lose, I'm not going to charge you for what we lost. And so you have some real money to play with. And, okay, all right, we'll do that. Well, they did 7 ARV experiments. Each one of them was correct, which amounted to 7 trades on the stock market. They turned the $10,000 into $26,000. And the dot-com
was very pleased. That's more than double your money.
That's right. And that was just in the last, 2 weeks of school or something, So.
How long did it take them to make that kind of money?
It took them about, it was the last 2 weeks of school. I couldn't tell you how many hours they put into it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I had a student who actually beat the Texas Pick 3 lottery twice in 2 weeks using ARV. So just to show that you can actually make money with this. And that's one reason people come. Another reason is maybe they want to help the police if they can get in. They might want to do missing children, things like that. But I have to say, and there are other reasons as well, but I have to say the main reason people come to take my class is they're trying to develop evidence, prove to themselves that they really are more than their physical bodies, that they really are more than society claims humans are. You know how our culture kind of says we're all just meat machines and when we die, we're done.
In other words, it's a kind of a quest to see if there's afterlife or whatever.
In a way, or you might even say, to some degree, it's self-actualization. Like Maslow talked about his hierarchy of needs, right? And the top thing that people do is trying to find out who they really are and maximize their potential. And this is one way of finding part of our potential that is generally denied by our culture, that it doesn't exist. And these guys come and they take the class and they find that it really does exist, because they produce evidence. In fact, that's one of the really exciting things about being an instructor, teaching people in remote viewing, is to watch that epiphany they have when they're sitting there working and they get done and you give them their feedback and they look at it and they realize, holy cow, I really did get information about this target that I had no way of getting except psychically. I mean, it's just like this whole light goes on. They intellectually believed it for a long time, but there's something about actually doing it yourself that is just, life-changing almost.
Now, have you embraced the paranormal more since you perfected this yourself? Do you deal in other realities? Some remote viewers do, I know.
One thing.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just curious.
I'm just trying to think of the best way to answer this. Okay, so to start off with, I was somewhat skeptical, right? And so in that respect, I've certainly embraced it more, because now I know that our minds really are more than our physical bodies. We really can essentially transcend time and space with our consciousness. We're not locked inside our skulls, right? That is very profound. The other side of it, though, is, further, I also recognize that there are other so-called paranormal modalities out there that there probably is substance to. Now, on the other hand, in some ways, ironically, I've become more skeptical about claims that people make. Because when I see the wild claims people make about remote viewing, when I know what's true about it, and then when I see people make wild claims about UFOs or about, well, cryptozoology, for example, and stuff, generally I've come to where I can recognize whether there's some substance to a claim, whether there isn't, just by the way it's presented. Now,
and there's at least two and probably more sides to that issue. You mentioned other realities in a way about UFOs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if a guy really believes in this thing, for instance, like a UFO or being able to go to Mars and see life, mm-hmm. I guess maybe that has some sort of impact on your psychic anyway.
Well, it probably does, and I actually was going to mention UFOs. I'm glad you brought that up. One thing that I have come to believe is that there really is, I have other reasons for this as well, but my remote viewing has kind of helped me come to terms with the fact that there really is something going on in UFO, this UFO phenomena, that I really am convinced that there is some kind of intelligent life involved in this, and that it is extraterrestrial in some sense of that word. There's a number of ways that could be, right? Although I have to say, I already had some reason to accept it in that, or at least that there's intelligent life on other planets. I like to joke that I belong to the only Christian denomination that actually believes, as a matter of doctrine, that there is life, intelligent life on other planets. That's one thing people aren't aware. I'm a Mormon, and there's a tenet in Mormonism that believes that that God created intelligent life on other planets as well, and that's been a doctrinal point for almost 200 years now. So that made it a little easier, to go on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also recognize that a lot of what's said about UFOs just isn't true. You know, you hear a lot of stories, a lot of speculation, a lot of
What throws up a red flag when somebody says something about UFOs that you just don't believe is true at all?
Well, when they start talking about, I almost hesitate to get into this because I'm probably going to make somebody mad. But when they start talking about, I don't know, the Pleiadians, for example, you know, you start digging into the source for their information. If they're getting it from like channeled entities and stuff, yeah, I find that very dubious. If their source is not really anything that seems concrete, I'm dubious. A lot of the actual observations I think are legitimate. People talk about seeing things and they describe them in pretty good detail, and they are credible folks. I think they probably are seeing something legitimate. One of my brothers had a UFO observation that doesn't seem the way he described it could at all possibly have been any kind of aircraft or anything. It sounded like it had to be something outside of our realm of knowledge. And he is absolutely
where did he see
UFO
this thing?
Actually, driving up to the middle of Nevada in the middle of the night. I grew up in southern Nevada, and a big chunk of my family still lives there. And my parents had gotten in a car accident up near Wells, Nevada. And so my brother and his wife had to go up to... Yes, yeah.
I used to live in Las Vegas, too, so...
Oh, did you? Okay, well, yeah, they were going up, I think it was 93, when it goes up through PH,
yeah.
You know, up that way. Mm-hmm. And they were out on the flats and driving along about, I don't know, I think he said it was about midnight. They were going up to try and help my parents out, and his wife was asleep, so she didn't see it, but he saw a string of lights flying and going along through the air. And the way he described them, which I'm a little vague now, but I think they're big and round and yellow or something like that, he said at a certain point they were going along and all of a sudden they changed direction, but they didn't just change direction. It's like if you saw a row of ducks go along and then each duck turned off after the others, you know, so it's like a right angle turn, each one following the next one. He said there was no banking, there was no curving around in a turn like you'd see in an aircraft, he said it didn't look like anything he'd ever seen helicopters do. He said they were going along at a good rate of speed, and all of a sudden, one after the other, just literally made a 90-degree turn and went in a different direction. And I found that very interesting, I have no, and of course the setting was great for this kind of thing, right? But in my book, I actually tell about another UFO observation from a friend of mine who, again, is not a UFO buff by any stretch of the imagination. He's an Air Force fighter pilot, in fact. He was, this is during Desert Storm, Desert Shield, actually, but in northern Saudi Arabia. He was in a scout helicopter with an Army pilot, and they were scouting out telecommunications nodes to post down for their various communications tasks. And they were flying along, and Kent said he saw this shadow tracking across the desert. And he said the shadow was huge. And he knows his aircraft. This guy, you know, he's a career Air Force fighter pilot, right? He knows his aircraft. So the shadow was huge, and it was very well defined, so it had to be fairly close. But he and the helicopter pilot could not see anything that was casting that shadow. They plotted where it would have had to be. And he said it was coming at about, he would estimate about 1,000 knots. We're talking, you know, afterburner speed for an aircraft. You know?
Yeah, which is trucking.
Yeah, so, exactly. So you know, he could be off because he was in an OH-58 and they were at altitude, you know. But they tried to see the thing casting a shadow, and he said they couldn't see anything. So they were in such a position that they could fly an intercept course with a shadow. And so they did. And just as they approached where the shadow would have tracked past them, it stopped dead. He said there was no deceleration. It just stopped dead. And they're going, what? You know, and then all of a sudden it started again and kept on going. And they're looking at each other, well, what the heck? They saw nothing to cast the shadow. It was going, you know, very rapidly and stopped suddenly and then started suddenly. And it did nothing in our inventory or anybody else's that we know of had any kind of capability like that. And so they went off and, you know, completely flummoxed. They went off and did their mission. And as they were coming back, roughly the same area, they saw the shadow coming back the direction that it had left in, and they watched it go right on out of sight. And Kent is absolutely an excellent observer, and he absolutely has no dogs in any UFO fight. This is completely out of the blue when he told it to me. So I really believe those kind of accounts very strongly.
Can a good remote viewer target one of these craft and figure out who's inside driving it?
Well, the answer is yes, but that's not the whole story. The problem is you don't know whether a remote viewer has done that because you can't get ground truth on it, right? And the problem with remote viewing is sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. And the times it doesn't work, remote viewers can be subject to what you call, you know, coming up with a fantasy story, right? Something just came into their head.
Yeah, like it gets back to my question earlier about if they tend to believe something, whether or not that has an effect. I guess it does sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, there's another problem with remote viewing that people don't recognize, and that is there's this thing that we call telepathic overlay, for want of a different term. And that is the possibility that the remote viewer may pick up somebody else's mental impressions about what something might be. So the story I've told in the past is kind of like this. Let's say there's somebody who believed very strongly that there was a UFO event, but the UFO event actually never happened. It was just somebody's imagination, right? But this person really believed it and wanted a remote viewer to remote view that event, that so-called event that never happened. So they get the remote viewer, and one thing you have to remember about remote viewing, to do it right, you have to be blind to the target. You cannot know what the target is. And so a remote viewer is kind of helpless in that respect, at the mercy of the tasker, the person that makes the tasking, because...
So it's really not possible to sit down and just task yourself to find out something, right?
Well, you can do that, but then you can't count on the data. The reason is because if you know what the target is, then everything that you can guess about it, everything you can infer about it, everything you've heard about it, anything you might suspect about it, that's all in your head, along with trying to get the signal, right? And that clouds the information. And so when you do get your information and write it down, sketch it, whatever you're doing, you can never be absolutely sure that what you put down there wasn't just your own left brain guessing rather than actual signal from a target, right? So the cleanest and the most accurate remote viewing is going to be done by a viewer who doesn't know what the target is, but is directed to the target by someone who just has, like I mentioned before, just an arbitrary number that stands for what that target might be that won't telegraph any information to the viewer. And so going back to this UFO tasking, let's say that the event never happened, but the tasker believed it did. And they task this viewer on it. The viewer's blind. They give him a targeting number, and the viewer goes along and starts reporting on this UFO event and describes it just how the tasker thought it was. Well, the tasker thinks that he's got validation from this thing, from the remote viewing, but what all that's happened is that the remote viewer's subconscious went to the target, found out there was no target there, and so went looking for the next most powerful psychic signal line, and it turned out to be, of course, the preconceptions of the person who assigned the target in the first place. And so the subconscious says, okay, well, here's some information about this target, and pulls it out of the subconscious of the tasker, and then reports it back, and the tasker thinks he's been validated when all it was is he got his own story back again. I hope
I just got an email from a guy named Robert Collins in Dayton, Ohio.
He's
a retired Air Force captain who's written a book about UFOs. But he's been seeing the same UFO in the same area near his house since July 17th of this year. And he says he just saw it again last night at 9:10. And I was just wondering if somebody that has some kind of recurring sighting like this, if remote viewing could help them figure that out.
See, that's a more useful way of applying remote viewing in a setting like this, is if you get somebody who has no opinion on what the thing is, but there is some kind of phenomenon that's been observed, right? There's something real there. What it is, we don't know, but we know there's something real there. A viewer could be tasked on that, even could be tasked, let's say, 9:10 yesterday, did you say?
Yeah.
Whatever time you said.
Okay, last night, 9:10
okay.
p.m.
So it could be tasked in this way. Describe the event that occurred at 9:10 on, let's see, yesterday, 19 August 2012 at such and such a location. And that could be tasked to the remote viewer in the way you task remote viewers. You wouldn't necessarily give them that kind of information, right? But
when you were working for the military, and when you were in the military, and I hope this is not anything that you can't talk about, but maybe it is that the way they task you to find out assignments and things? I mean,
well, no, what they would
say, well, like we're going to invade this area, this port, or whatever. I mean, I don't know what the kind of assignments they have.
Go ahead.
What kind of assignments do they give you in the military?
For example, we worked Soviet weapon, new Soviet weapon systems. There might be a report of a new Soviet weapon system inside someplace, and they would task us to describe the interior of a building where they thought there might be some useful information, right, about this. They might test us against an event, such as a Soviet weapons test or a Soviet particle beam weapons test or something like that. They might task us on, and this actually happened, it was before my time, but the remote viewer was asked to remote view in fact, it was Ingo Swan, the guy who invented remote viewing, was asked to remote view a Chinese nuclear test 3 days before it happened, describe what he saw, and he described what he saw, and it indicated that the test was going to be a failure. And it turned out it was, but I just read this story, and I'm a little vague on how it happened. What happened was the Chinese were going to test a nuclear weapon, and it failed, but they were still celebrating. And the reason was because it failed in such a way that they knew that it would have worked had they done it a little bit differently or something like that, mm-hmm. right? And anyway, Ingo Swann accurately described the setting, the situation, the event, so that he got correct what it was going to happen. So that's an example. We did the hostage situation in the Middle East, trying to find people like Terry Waite or Colonel Higgins. That was.
And that leads me to a question, but if the military is not using it now, or CIA either, I mean, do you think remote viewing might have played a part in locating Osama bin Laden?
Well, that question floats around a lot. At least according to the official story, I'd say probably not. But, you know, you can't rule it out. It's hard to prove a negative. And you know, I don't know. We've done some stuff for the military, I and my little team. But it was not anything like that. We tried to find a soldier that had been kidnapped in a convoy attack back in 2005. And we were asked by the general officer in a major command who had lost the soldier. He asked us to help him find it. It was all pro bono, and it was not classified, although it was sensitive. So it's possible they might have, somebody might have approached some remote viewers to try and help them find bin Laden, you know, and I can't rule it out. I'm not going to try and...
The reason I say that, Lynn Buchanan said he offered one time, they said no thanks.
Okay, that's interesting. I haven't heard that before. I'm sorry, he said somebody asked him to do it?
Yeah. No, he asked them if they needed any help.
Oh, and they said no thanks. Oh, yeah. That would not surprise me at all. Excuse me. I would not be surprised that was the reaction it got.
I want to get to the past lives and future lives and events. I have trouble wrapping my mind around those things. I take you at your word that time and space are not important in remote viewing.
Well, I didn't say the
It looks to me like you'd be changing events, especially if you went back in the past. Maybe not. Have you ever done anything from the past?
You would do stuff all the time in the past.
I was asking, you mentioned your religion, that you're a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you'd tried to check on anything in the Book of Mormon or the Holy Bible.
I generally leave faith-based things alone. There are folks who like to play around with those, but...
Yeah, I understand, and I kind of try to leave them alone, too.
Yeah.
Because I have all kinds of people listening.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that somebody would have checked on a lot of things.
Well, some people try.
Here again, I guess there's no proof. Huh? I mean, you take the remote viewer.
That's the problem. That's the problem. And you could get it wrong, right? The remote viewing isn't 100%. You make mistakes, and sometimes you're completely off. And so if you have a faith-based thing, and how do you know whether you got it right or not? You know, you could totally destroy your faith with a false positive, right?
Yeah. If your subconscious plays any role at all in this stuff, it seems to me that if your faith would be one of those things that you wouldn't want to tamper with too much, because you wouldn't know how, because most people have a faith that they're very strong in whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. So, of course it would be great if you could check all those faith claims, right? You know, if you could go back and find out if Moses really led the children of Israel out of Egypt, or if you could go back and find out if Jesus really was crucified. In fact, I think one guy he had on, Courtney Brown, did a project where he claims that remote viewing showed that the crucifixion didn't happen, right, or something along those lines. You know, I just find all that kind of stuff dubious, that approach to remote viewing. And
we had Courtney on with our remote viewing show, and we had a difference of opinion, which we knew we would at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's an interesting man, no doubt about it, but... He's strong in his viewpoints, and other people are strong in theirs. Somebody wrote me an email about listening to that show, and they said, "Well, one thing, the remote viewers they got bigger egos than entertainers."
Well, now think about it. considering you're doing something that's swimming upstream of society, it takes a pretty big ego to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to say, you know, Courtney is, he's very committed, and he's got a lot of energy, and he's, you know, a lot of ambition to try and, you know, try to do the best he can with the remote viewing stuff. And some of the stuff he does really good, but we do have differences of opinion on stuff. And I think that, for example, the Jesus thing, I just, you know, I have doubts about that process. So, but it doesn't mean remote viewing is not a good tool and that he hasn't done good work with it, you know.
Lynn Buchanan uses a team sometimes on subjects like this. I know he did on the Aztec UFO crash.
Yeah,
12 different remote viewers.
Courtney does too. He doesn't do all the viewing himself or anything like that. I mean, he gets endless other viewers come in. But and in fact, you're crazy if you try and base everything on a single remote viewer. Although some people can pull it off to some degree. Joe McMonigle, for example. As far as I know, he does all of his viewing individually, you know, just as he does the viewing himself. But he has gotten so good at it that he's very successful. I mean, he's very successful, and, you know, it's hard to gauge anything that Joe does in the remote viewing world, you know, operationally. He does get some things wrong, as everybody does, but his track record is probably the best in the business right now. So,
yeah, we were talking about UFOs a little earlier,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to me, and this is only collateral information because I haven't surveyed every remote viewer, but it seems that many remote viewers are open to the idea of life from other worlds or other
mm-hmm.
places,
mm-hmm.
more than maybe other scientists. And do you think of yourself as a scientist? As a remote viewer?
You know, it all depends. I guess the standard cultural definition of scientist, I don't think I would count as a scientist, at least not as a professional scientist, right? I don't know of any actual practicing remote viewers that would count in that definition. But I think we can do science if we do it properly, right? And I feel like I have done some science. We did a very interesting project trying to determine if a random event generator would detect, I guess to use the term loosely, would detect remote viewing influence. And our indications are that it does, or that it did in our experiment anyway. So,
mm-hmm.
And that was very carefully done, and I count that as a scientific experiment. And I think that anyone...
Well, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't insisting that you're a physicist or something.
Okay.
I mean, you're using the scientific principle, it seems to me,
sure.
and getting things validated.
Yeah, and if you're careful and you follow the scientific method and you follow proper protocols, And I think that there's even amateurs can do really good science as long as they follow the rules, you know. And I think there are those in the remote viewing field who are doing that. So,
is there something you'd like to bring up about remote viewing? I haven't gone to the phones yet, and the reason is that you and I've had a pretty interesting conversation here, and keep getting more questions, you know. So something
yeah,
you'd
I
like
understand.
To bring up?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, is there something you'd like to bring up here?
Not really, not in the amount of time we have left. Probably would be nice to get, if you've got some questions
we can,
out there.
You know, we are clock bound like every radio show, but I've been known to go over, so.
Let me say one thing. So my website, we already gave that out. Folks go to my website. There's actually availability. We didn't get into it, but maybe on a different show we could. Dowsing and remote viewing, because dowsing is a secondary interest of mine when it comes to remote viewing.
Tell me about that for a minute. What you're talking about.
Well, part of the problem with remote viewing, and people, there are two things people always want you to do when they find out you're psychic. They want you to predict the future, or they want you to find something that's missing, right? And ironically, those are the two hardest things for any kind of psychic modality to do, including remote viewing. And there's a whole long story to that, so we probably don't have time for that. But one of the problems was using remote viewing to find things. The best you can do is describe the setting and then hope somebody recognizes it, right? So when we got asked to find a lot of things, like narco trafficking, you know, shipments, hostages in the Middle East, whatever, we were having a tough time with that. And we decided, well, let's try dowsing, okay? And dowsing, I like to talk about as being kind of like the inverse of remote viewing. So in remote viewing, understand this is very roughly expressed. Remote viewing, you know where something is, you don't know what it is. In dowsing, you know what it is, but you don't know where it is. So it's like they're kind of just the opposite of each other, and if you can get them to work together, they can kind of fill in each other's weaknesses. And so that's what we did. Yeah. We developed. I'm sorry?
Dowsing seems to have a new legitimacy these days.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to feel pretty good about it.
Yes, and it actually did work for us. But one of the products that I helped produce is a training set. People who want to learn the same lessons we learned in the military unit with dowsing can acquire that set and actually go through a training process and learn a number of the skills that we developed while we were using dowsing in the remote viewing unit. That whole set is on sale, but I wanted to tell people about actually a free product. There's kind of an introductory DVD about dowsing that kind of talks about how dowsing and remote viewing interact. And
how do they get the DVD on your website?
They can go to my website, which is rviewer.com, and there's a banner there towards the top. You click on it, says free DVD, and you click on that. Or you can actually go to freedowsingdvd.com.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's folks like Hal Putoff, who is the scientist, one of the scientists very involved in this.
Yeah, a man of great reputation.
Yeah.
And he's down there with you, right?
In Austin, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's on the DVD, I'm on the DVD, there's a bunch of other folks on it. But it introduces this idea of remote viewing and dowsing. So, you know, if you're curious, go there. If you really are interested, you could go find the sale. I think it's probably linked from there for the set.
Brought up dowsing, which brings up an important question. I've always wanted to ask remote viewers. I never seem to get around to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to take the time to do this now and ask you. Why couldn't you use remote viewing for treasure hunting, you know, deep sea looking for gold and things like that?
It actually has been and could be. And I get a lot of questions. People want me to help them find treasure, and they say, yeah, if you find it, then I'll give you 10%. I say, why would I do that? Why wouldn't I just find it and keep it all, you know?
Yeah, you would keep the 100%.
Yeah, but
that was immediately what I thought about, Paul, when you said you had several companies or several things. I thought, well, maybe you got a company that follows these things up.
Yeah. Of course, you know, it has to be done right. You have to be fairly certain that there is a treasure. A lot of times these are speculative. People say, well, I heard this legend that there's some treasure buried somewhere in the whatever, you know. And that's just not worth the trouble, because the odds of finding something like that, even with an enhancement like remote viewing, are fairly slim. And it's a lot of work, frankly. It isn't just, like I said, a magic bullet. Finding things with remote viewing is a lot of darn work, because you have to do it carefully, you have to do it methodically, and so there's got to be a really good chance of payoff before I'm even interested. Yeah. But it has been done. I mean, in a research setting, Stephen Schwartz, who's been involved in this for a long time, used two of the early remote viewers, Ingo Swann, who's legendary, and Hella Hammond.
What kind of guy is Ingo? You know him, I guess.
Yeah, he's...
You met him at one time, I mean.
Oh, I've spent a lot of time with Ingo Swann.
Yeah.
I spent almost a good chunk of the entire year of 1984 with Ingo Swann, and of course have visited with him and communicated with him on many occasions since then. Ingo is a very forward-thinking individual. He's not doing well right now. He's having some health problems and stuff. I mean, he is nearly 80. He's almost 80 years old, so he's having some health issues. But you know, he's still a thinker. He's still a source of information. But he was the one that actually developed remote viewing, and then through a whole series of events, got together with Hal Puthoff at SRI International, and they ended up developing the program that became remote viewing as we know it today. And he very interested in a lot of different things, explored a lot of things, but very methodical in his approach, which was those two things are essentially. You had to be open-minded, you had to be intellectually adventurous, and you had to be methodical, too. All of those things had to come together, and they did with Ingo Swann. And he was able to very brilliantly, actually, develop this whole discipline that that has essentially, in a certain respect, changed the world.
Very interesting. And what you say about Helm and a few others is not surprising. And you seem to have those attributes too, Paul. You seem to be able to have an open mind at the same time, be a little methodical.
Well, I try hard. Some people sometimes think I'm a little hard-headed, but
A hard-headed, maybe you really believe in your tenets of whatever it is about what you're doing, and you don't want to get compromised. So that's admirable. Okay, give your website.
rviewer.com. That's rviewer.com. I have a phone number, too, which is 866-229-7847, toll-free. 866-229-7847.
Okay, and when this interview appears as a podcast on our website, we'll have links to all of that at jerrypippin.com, and people can write us if they need to get a hold of you, if they miss something there, or enter your name, or put go to that website. It's pretty good. Your website.
Yep. It's got a lot of stuff on it, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Paul will do another show soon.
Hey, I would love to do that, and I'll tell you, you've been a great host. I appreciate it very much.
It's been interesting, and you just so I understand, you're open-minded to the idea of UFOs and extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
In fact, you may be a little more than open-minded.
Well, I have to tell you, I am absolutely convinced. But I am cautious. I'm cautious about a lot of the stories. But I am pretty well convinced that there is something there. I've even written a couple articles for UFO Magazine, actually, about UFO and remote viewing. So
right.
I don't know if you subscribe or not, but you might want to check those out.
Okay. Maybe people can look those up, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Paul Smith, everyone.
And that wraps up our show for tonight. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.